For AntiWar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas, I'm Scott Horton, and this is Anti-War Radio. This one's for Tatiana.
The Mason's wall, but I'm the head cornerstone who could ruin it all. The population really needs to get hip to the hustle. 10% live in abundance while the rest struggle. I'm on the west coast of Babylon living in fear, and God's coming for retribution. I don't want to be here when the comet hits or the bomb drops, and all the wicked administrations to the corrupt cops, the bad teachers and false prophets, y'all gonna pay the pain for yesterday's atrocities we're feeling today. And it's a sad state for those who choose to ignore it, competing with the Jones and nothing to show for it. Cold world people caused by the love of money, and in this cap idolism ain't a damn thing funny. 24/7 live mind control, the man got us plugged in, slowly stealing our soul. Grab hold of your faculties with the time you're allotted. The new world's now in order and the course has been plotted. Stand in line for the chip and the form you bought it. On the thought control, we need love, peace, and happiness all over the globe. We don't need no education, on the thought control. We need love, peace, and happiness all over the globe. My public education never meant shit to me. That's why I'm out here grinding, trying to peddle this weed. I know a lot of smart brothers with college degrees, but when it comes to making paper, they're broker than me. Shit, I never knew the meaning of a GED. It stands for grinding every day, or your ass won't eat. You ever wonder why they call LA the melting pot? They added pistols, cracking A's just to see what they got. It's called genocide, with a very specific purpose. It's killing black and Latinos, and all of us should be nervous. You need proof? Look what they did to the natives. Smallpox, booze, and treachery, the devil's created. Place chiefs wanna slap them in a reservation. I'm talking project tenements from the plantation. And in the penitentiary, they're doing castrations, putting poison in the food so you can't taste them. But the trickery ain't fooling me, I'm schooling the youth. And we don't need no education, what we need is the truth. Hey, teacher, why don't you leave the kids alone? We don't need no education, no thought control. We need love, peace, and happiness all over the globe. We need love, peace, and happiness all over the globe.
Everybody, this is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. And this is the part of the show where I should have figured out something to talk about by now. But yeah, I haven't done that. So I know what I'll do. I'll talk about antiwar.com. You guys ought to be reading antiwar.com every day. That's what I do. That's where all the bad news in the whole wide world is. And basically nothing gets by Jason Ditz and Eric Garris. All the news of relevance every day, updated all day in real time. Antiwar.com. And let's see, my blog is thestressblog.com. Invite you guys to stop by there. All my interviews that I do on this show are posted at scotthortonshow.com and also at antiwar.com in the Antiwar Radio section right there at the top of the page. So you can listen to all these interviews. ScottHortonShow.com has just mine. If you go to Anti-War Radio, also the interviews of Charles Goyette are there too. And yeah, so that's that. And oh, LibertyStickers.com. You ever drive around in traffic and you think of something that you wish everyone behind you in traffic would have to read about how much you hate the government? That's how I am. I've done a lot of driving for a living in my life. And I spent a lot of time thinking, ooh, I wish I had a bumper sticker that said this or that. Well, so now I got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them for sale over there at LibertyStickers.com, which I no longer own, but I still got a deal with Rick, who I sold it to. And so I get a dollar or something if you buy one out of the Scott Horton section. But I made up most of them on the site, like 90-something percent of them. So anyway, even if you don't want to spend money, you'll at least have fun, get some laughs cruising through the stickers at LibertyStickers.com. That's all I got to say about that. This is, of course, Chaos Radio, streaming live worldwide, KAOS959.com. And I'm glad I babbled about all of those websites, because it gave me an opportunity to remember that I did, in fact, have something to talk about at the start of the show today. I almost don't believe it, except for it's written by Ralph Blumenthal, and Ralph Blumenthal is a hell of a great reporter. Ask yourself, where do I know that name? Ralph Blumenthal. He writes for the New York Times, doesn't he? Why, yes, he does write for the New York Times. And now, what articles have I ever read by Ralph Blumenthal that would make me think that he's a reporter worth putting a little bit of stock in, as opposed to, say, for example, Michael R. Gordon, his colleague over at the New York Times? Anybody? Huh? Anybody? I bet somebody out there is raising their hand. I know, I know. Yeah, he's the guy that wrote all about how the FBI had infiltrated the terrorist ring that blew up the World Trade Center in 1993. Pulled their informant off the case, and Youssef was brought in, and the bomb went off, killed six people. Boy, I bet Clinton is just kicking himself now, huh? Oh man, I could have had a war on terror. What was I thinking? I was too busy murdering the Branch Davidians to focus on Ramzi Youssef and his crew. Poor Bill. Such a blown opportunity for greatness, you know? Anyway, yeah, it was Ralph Blumenthal that wrote all about that for the New York Times back in the day. But anyway, check out this. Check out this headline. I saw this last night. I thought, no. No, this just can't be. Governor Rick Perry commutes sentence in Texas. Houston, August 30th, hours before his scheduled execution as a disputed accomplice in a 1996 murder, Kenneth Foster won a rare commutation to life in prison on Thursday after Governor Rick Perry followed the recommendation of the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles and granted a death row reprieve. The case had raised international protests because Mr. Foster, 30, was not the gunman, but the driver of a getaway car in a San Antonio robbery spree that ended in murder. He was convicted under a Texas law that makes co-conspirators liable in certain cases of homicide. I don't know if this is exactly the way the law is now, but I know as recently as, say, 8 or 10 years ago, there was, and I believe this is still the case, there's no accessory to murder statute in Texas. You're either the murderer too, or you're not, which means that if you're the driver of the getaway car, or even if you're asleep in the back seat, then you're guilty of the murder too, or nothing. No accessory to commit murder statute in the penal code here. And so this guy, Kenneth Foster Jr., drove the getaway car, this robbery in San Antonio, and he was about to go to the needle room to be murdered by the state of Texas in a premeditated fashion. And Rick Perry commuted his sentence? What's the payoff there, Rick? Believe me, the payoff isn't satisfying voters in Texas. they'd just as soon you kill all of them too. What possible motivation could Rick Perry have for commuting the sentence of somebody who, you know, just because he doesn't deserve to die, you know? That's really puzzling. I guess I could read further on in the article and see if, you know, there's a reason quoted in there, but why bother? This hardly absolves Rick Perry of the rest of the crimes he's committed and aided and abetted in his time as governor of Texas. This is what my dad says about Rick Perry. He says, how's a guy who's been nothing but a politician his entire life, he's had nothing but government jobs his entire life, walk around every day in $6,000 suits? Huh? How exactly does that work, huh? That doesn't tell you everything you need to know about Rick Perry. Well, then, I guess you're just really dumb and can't figure out what I meant by that or something. I don't know. Anyway, I just thought that was funny. But yeah, so there you go. Rick Perry actually does something that's good. Not just not evil, but a good thing. He commuted the death sentence for somebody who clearly did not deserve the needle. I was reading an article about this case just the other day, and they were describing just how much the law that the man's convicted under in Texas centers on what was going on in the mind, what he knew or should have known or believed or should have believed would be a likely occurrence and so forth like that. And it seems to me, unless you have someone saying, well, we're going to go do 6 robberies today, and I'll bet you by the time we're done, somebody's going to die. Unless you have them quoted as saying that, then, you know, really, how do you know? And, you know, I don't know. I'm not for armed robbery. Do people know that stealing is wrong? Everybody's got a right to that which they, you know, justly acquire. And it's not okay to take it. Of course, this is what happens when we're all educating government schools, and they teach us that government's our dad, and we're supposed to follow their example. What does our government do all day long? That's right, rob and murder people. It's funny, in fact, that was Timothy McVeigh's defense at his mass murder trial, which he was guilty as hell, but that was a kangaroo trial. I mean, come on, guys, give me a break. I mean, just in numbers of people not allowed to testify. Come on. But that's what McVeigh said. He got up there and he quoted, of course, a Supreme Court justice, an ultimate bureaucrat, and said, government is the father, government is the teacher, I'm following your example. The people in that building full of government employees are a target. Any innocents who might be there are collateral damage, he said. I learned this in my army training when I went and fought the Iraqis in the first Gulf War, he said. So it makes sense that you would have people educated in government schools, you know, who, you know, therefore have no skills or future and short time preferences and so forth, who are going to go around armed robbing people, acting like it's the right thing. I shouldn't really blame government. I blame individuals for committing crimes like that. But still, the guy obviously doesn't deserve the needle for driving a getaway car in a crime that they can prove they cannot prove he knew was going to take place. Not the murder part of it anyway. But yeah, so wow, here we are spiraling into an American Orwellian police state, and then a funny thing like Rick Perry commutes a sentence happens. Isn't that a strange thing? Maybe we'll talk about that with Will Grigg here after this song by Discharge. This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. I think we'll play, yeah, this one.
Some gates it is, some gates it is.
On the show to discuss America's rapid descent into a fascist police state. And the headline in the New York Times is that the governor of Texas, Rick Perry, has actually commuted the sentence of somebody on death row. Isn't that like impossible or something? A bit counterintuitive to the topic, but I guess that's the way it is. You guys know Will Grigg. He's the editor of The Right Source Online and writes the great blog Pro Libertate, which you can find at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Welcome to the show, Will.
Thanks so much, Scott. It's great to be with you again.
Can you imagine Rick Perry commuting the sentence of a guy on death row? And he was black.
Well, sir, wonders never cease. In this case, I guess it's wonders commencing. No, I saw that, and I was completely astonished because as late as yesterday, I, among other people, thought that there was no possibility that that sort of thing would happen. You know, Texas is sort of a state that has distinguished itself for the promiscuous use of the death chamber, and there is this folk wisdom about how if you ride with an outlaw, you die with an outlaw. And in this particular case, you're dealing with somebody who obviously had not positively taken a step toward killing somebody. And there was pretty compelling evidence that he wasn't aware that there was going to be lethal violence the night that he was on this ride-along. And I, from what I understand, I'm not all that conversant with the details of the case. Apparently, you're dealing with what could be considered an act of whimsical homicide on the part of somebody who was in the car that this fellow was driving. And since there wasn't premeditation involved, you really can't make the case that he was constructively involved in that lethal crime. And that's the sort of case that those of us who are skeptical of the use of the death penalty would mount on behalf of the fellow. It's just amazing, as you pointed out, Scott, that the governor of Texas, who's a Democrat-turned-Republican of no particular distinction in terms of principle, would commute that sentence. So that's a cheerful augury amidst so much gloom.
Right, and, you know, especially when, as you say, I guess you call it the promiscuous use of the death penalty here in Texas. I think I read something not too long ago that said Harris County, Houston, just the court system down there has as many people executed as the whole communist state of a billion people in China.
That's amazing.
You know, it's very comparable anyway. I think China may be ahead of Harris County by just a few. But yeah, I know, but the ranking is, it's Harris County, and then Texas, and then the United States, and then I guess China's in there somewhere. You know.
Puts things in a rather ominous perspective.
It really does. You know, people still get choked up. You know, home of the brave, land of the free. People, you know, tighten their fist and put it up by their heart and get all teary-eyed. And, oh, man, we're so free. And yet, in a country of 300 million people, we have more people in prison than the state of China, where it's just assumed that, where the premise of the entire state is that it created you and, mm-hmm. and lets you be relatively free at its whim. We have more people in prison than them? How can that be?
Well, that's one element here of this larger story that I wish more people to pay attention to, the fact that we have a larger prison population, you just said, than an overtly communist state. Probably, if I'm not mistaken, one of the three or four that still lays proud claim, I suppose, to being heirs of Marx and Lenin. Although in the case of China, you're dealing with sort of an authoritarian corporate state that's ruled by an oligarchy that's sort of a new class type of group that professes fealty to Marxism, Leninism, Maoism, and Deng Xiaoping thought. But what they mean basically is, well, the state rules everything, and however we justify that claim in whatever obscure document or doctrine we can find some purchase on power, we'll lay claim to that. But apart from that, you can pretty much do what you want as long as you're making money and you obey our dictates. I mean, there's not really so much ideology behind what China does as pure brute authoritarianism.
Right.
But notwithstanding that fact, it is a pretty awful regime, and they have over a billion people under the rule of that tiny oligarchy, and the population of the United States is a rounding error when you're trying to calculate how many Chinese there are in the world, and yet we have more people in prison than the Chinese government does. That's a very sobering indication of what's really going on. And furthermore, I believe, and I've not been able to prove this because I'm still crunching the numbers, but probably the number of nonviolent offenders in U.S. prisons outstrips the number of people in prison in China. I've not been able to confirm that, but I suspect that might be the case.
Mm-hmm.
You're not dealing with people who've committed actual crimes against persons or property. You're talking about people who are there in large measure because of the so-called war on drugs, which is a prohibitionist policy that, like all prohibitionist policies, is completely illegitimate. You really should not have the government in the business of criminalizing vices. That's a really good way to expand the power of the state, a terrific way to destroy individual liberty, and also a pretty good way to abet the growth of vice. It's really a trifecta there in terms of the pure futility of the policy.
Well, you're just a dope-smoking hippie, right?
That must be. Anybody who's seen a photograph or seen a photograph of me with my family would probably think we're dubious candidates for enrollment in the counterculture. But the point here is that if you examine this policy in terms of what it does to individual freedom and what it does to public morality as well, meaning in this case, the central morality of the Christian tradition, which has to do with the two great commandments, you know, and that resonates with the policy of non-aggression, the non-aggression principle of libertarianism. You don't transgress against the rights of your neighbor. That's, I think, the paramount public moral question. The central question of public morality is, does it encourage or does it discourage aggression against the rights of your neighbor? And measured from that perspective of morality, the drug war is just a horrible failure, and it's an outrage, it's a screaming atrocity. But the thing I find really interesting in the context of this discussion, Scott, is the news item that was in WorldNet Daily this morning about the fact that there was a regulation enacted back on the 14th of February 2005 that permits once again, the creation of civilian inmate labor camps on military bases, or at least military-owned assets. And the thing that I'm looking at, the thing that I'm thinking as I look at this story, is that you're dealing here with something that in principle is not all that different from the notorious Logai inmate labor camps that are run by the Chinese military, where you have people who have been found guilty of committing various offenses that would not be considered crimes against persons and property, just crimes against what that government is pleased to call public order, who are taken into the Chinese gulag and then used to manufacture products that are marketed on behalf of the so-called People's Liberation Army. In this instance, the U.S. version would allow civilian inmate labor to be building facilities, including other prisons or military assets, and probably in the long run, given the fact that we have this blending of these large politically connected corporations and this large omnivorous government, you're probably going to have them manufacturing something that would be sold for profit, most likely by military contractors like KBR, Halliburton. You know the Constellation as well as I do. But you have really a huge instance of moral hazard here when you have a nonviolent inmate labor program. That's why emphasizing the fact that we have such a huge population of nonviolent offenders who are behind bars, who would be used as uncompensated labor on behalf of what we now have to call the military-industrial national security, military-industrial national security and prison complex.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same kind of an arrangement they have in China. It's just China is more forthright about what they're doing than the rulers are.
And now when you talk about these new camps being set up and so forth, we've heard about this kind of thing for years, and I don't know if anybody's really keeping count, but I guess at this point I'm under the impression that there are already a lot of empty prisons sitting basically in waiting around this country.
Yeah.
That's the thing that really gets me is, mm-hmm. you know, here you have Supermax facility here and Supermax facility there, and yet, and they're sitting empty, and they're building more and more of these.
That's the thing that I think most people would find properly unsettling is the fact that when a government is building empty prisons, it obviously intends to fill them. And it's anticipating demand. I mean, you're building excess capacity into a system on the assumption that these things are not going to be lying fallow. I keep adverting to a story that's in Amanda Valladares' memoir, Against All Hope. Mr. Valladares was a Cuban poet who was thrown in prison when he was working for the post office in Cuba way back in the early 1960s, just after the revolution. He happened to make some kind of an untoward remark about Fidel Castro and the wisdom of the communist revolution in Cuba. And so he ended up spending over 20 years in the filthiest and most despicable dungeons of the Cuban communist regime. But one of the points he made was that before Castro, one of the previous rulers of Cuba, I can't remember which, I don't think it was Batista, I think it was somebody who predated him, had built this ridiculously huge prison complex, and nobody could understand why he did so. And so somebody, one of his advisors, ginned up the courage to ask the dictator why he'd done this. The dictator said, well, don't worry, someone will come along who'll fill it up. And that someone, of course, was Fidel Castro. And that's where Valladares spent 20 years of the prime of his life, paying the political penalty for speaking out very quietly against the regime. Now, when you see a government, any government, building empty prisons, it's not because they're going to demolish those prisons or convert them to a more suitable use. It's because they're anticipating their own policies will eventually bring in a windfall of inmates. And when I say windfall, I mean that in light of what we learned this morning, in a literal sense. You're talking about uncompensated labor that would be used on behalf not only of the government and its entities and appurtenances, like the Pentagon, for instance, but also on behalf of any of the corporations who are contractors or subcontractors working on behalf of the government. And that's the sort of thing, the latter relationship, that has really grown and proliferated under the Bush-Cheney administration.
Well, you know, it seems like with fascism, you get the worst of both worlds.
Indeed.
You have the coercive power of the state, and you also have businessmen who are willing, I mean, let's face it, from an amoral or an immoral point of view, a congressman is the best investment that a businessman can make.
Certainly.
And if you're in the steel bar or concrete manufacturing business, you're part of this prison industrial complex. Well, you're just going to keep buying congressmen and keep lobbying them to support the worst wars. And so you have this personal private profit motive with government taxation power and ultimately, you know, prison at the other end of it.
Sure.
And all of us are, I guess, just stuck either in the cages or emptying our wallet for them for somebody
else. Exactly. Yeah, whether emptying the wallet directly is through direct taxation or more subtly as through inflation, as government deficit spending is being used to prime the pump of this entire corrupt enterprise. And that steals, of course, from the purchasing power of our dollar and our savings and so forth. We're seeing a lot of that happen right now as the subprime mortgages are being bailed out and the lenders are being the beneficiaries of corporate welfare on Wall Street. But when you talk about the fact that there are so many of these corporate entities that opportunistically attach themselves to this military-industrial prison complex, you're talking about something Adam Smith referred to way back in the 18th century as the man of systems, somebody who snuggles up to a ruler so as to protect himself and his interests against competition in the free market. And Adam Smith, being a cynical and perceptive observer of human behavior, said something to the effect that you cannot have an association of merchants gather without them hatching some conspiracy against the interests of the public. And, of course, that's true when they're commingling with the government, government being, of course, a permanent conspiracy against the interests of the governed. Just one small example of what we're talking about, Scott, that I came across the other day was I was looking into what's happening in anticipation of Labor Day when we're going to have these federally subsidized DUI patrols and checkpoints pullulate across the countryside like so many noxious weeds. That happens almost every year at this time, and there's a reason for that. They're out fishing for revenue. You have state and municipal governments who don't have the luxury of inflating the currency so as to pay off their own constellation of constituents, so they have to send out the revenue farmers wearing the tin badges and other costume jewelry to shake down people on behalf of those governments.
Yeah, it's like the Christmas shopping season for local police departments.
Oh, yeah, you know, it's Christmas in August, for all the governments that afflict us. But one of the things we're talking about, we've seen quite frequently in recent years, is something called the DUI enforcement trailer, which is sort of a mobile detention center and testing facility. They'll attach a DUI enforcement trailer to a given roadblock or checkpoint. And it's not like the paddy wagon. It's not like you're going out and finding people who are obviously drunk and dissolute who have either caused trouble by starting some kind of a violent encounter in a bar, or that they're simply strewn in Skid Row where they're a threat to their own welfare, and so you have to pick them up, put them in the paddy wagon. This is something that is used to interrogate people and to use some technically and constitutionally dubious means of establishing whether or not they're driving under the influence, if they are, summarily to detain them there in this trailer. In doing some research on that subject, I came across an outfit called Universal Trailers. And one of the things that they manufacture is what they call an enforcement trailer. And it's just a standard shell. It looks like it could be something relatively innocuous, like your standard issue camper that you'd pull behind, for instance, a fifth wheel type of an arrangement. However, this, of course, is something which is being used here as an inducement to law enforcement agencies. And their sales pitch runs as follows. Universal makes all kinds of specialty trailers. All you need to do is tell us what you want. Below is the example, an example of a DUI trailer for police departments to haul all the gear you may need to set up a DUI checkpoint, available in various sizes and equipment configurations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Inside, you find many options for equipment, such as bench, base cabinets, wall cabinets, 110-volt fluorescent lights, windows, et cetera. We also offer generators and air conditioners to provide more comfort, for whom they don't say. And then this is the part that I found really provocative. For Homeland Security, there are many functions our trailers can help provide. So here they are out pitching to these police departments, which are pretty much now just local affiliates of a centralized Homeland Security entity anyway. I mean, the Homeland Security system is thoroughly unitary and centralized in a way that our founders never would have put up with for any length of time. But they know that there's a lot of money being sluiced into these supposedly local police departments and sheriff's departments and state police units from the federal government, and so they're trying to get in on the gravy train. Here, we offer this wonderful multi-use trailer, and here are some of the things that it can provide. That's, like I said, one small example of the type of rent-seeking corporatist opportunism that we see characterizing this metastasizing Homeland Security corporatist system we're living under.
Yeah, I saw a thing on MSNBC just a week or two ago where it was the same thing, and they pointed something to be scared of, in this case, Mexicans, and they had, it was an entire convention center somewhere in Arizona or New Mexico, I think, and it was an entire convention center full of entrepreneurs hawking their gadgets for chasing Mexican people back out of the country again. And this one guy's giving the lady, the MSNBC lady's walking around, and he's going, yeah, this here's a directed sound gun. What it does is it blasts holes in their eardrums. That'll make them run away.
Grief.
And they only cost a few hundred thousand dollars a piece. I hope you're watching, Congressman. I hope you're watching Appropriations Committee. You know, let's do this thing. And, you know, no one is going to spend their own money on something like this. Only through the coercive power of taxation is somebody like this scumbag going to make a living doing this kind of stuff.
Well, what you said about this system we're living under right now, which is economically best called corporatism, which was Mussolini's most famous innovation. Actually, he gets credit for it, but Lenin pioneered before Mussolini. The new economic program in the early 20s of the Soviet Union was corporatism. The biggest difference was that it was internationally subsidized by Western interests in Washington and London.
Well, you know, Edward Mandel House bragged that I anticipated Mussolini by several years.
Exactly. I mean, Philip Drew was basically the template for what you saw in the Soviet Union and later in Italy. And Italy's system didn't come into bad odor until after he had sort of snuggled up to Adolf Hitler in the late 1930s. Between the late 20s and, say, 1938 or so, Mussolini was actually somebody who was in high esteem on the part of opinion makers and academics and even some churchmen here in the United States. And when FDR sat down with his little clique to develop the New Deal, they used as their model the writings of Giovanni Gentile and some of the other fascist theoreticians in putting together their own model of the corporate state. And so this is something we've been dealing with for a long, long time. You can make a really good case that this actually started to afflict our country back in World War I, but it's now reaching the full malignant flower of the seeds that have been planted over a century ago when we see overtly this union between the worst elements of the coercive state, the military and law enforcement on the one hand, and then, as I said before, people who are in the corporate realm who want profit without risk. They're not entrepreneurs, really. Entrepreneurs are risk takers by the strict definition of the term. You minimize risk by becoming a political or economic concubine of the state. And the state's seraglio during the last 5 or 6 years has expanded dramatically, not only over here in the United States, but over in Iraq as well, where Reconstruction was just one riotous orgy of corporate corruption. And that's pretty much the model for the world that they want to inflict on the rest of us, the name of global democracy. It's actually a degenerate form of corporatism with all the overtones and appurtenances of fascism. And economically, it would be of very little use to anybody apart from those who are politically connected.
Hey, you just did such a good job explaining that. It made me think that we ought to take a little bit of extra time to go a little bit further, and maybe, Will, you and I can help convert a left-winger or two to libertarianism. It occurs to me that basically the case you just make, the libertarian case against corporatism, is by far the best one, that a liberal or leftist case against corporatism can only lead straight to total statism.
Yeah.
That the real opposite of this fascist system you describe is a laissez-faire free market system. And further, is it not the case, Will Grigg, that it was a bunch of sick, evil, conservative, right-wing, corporatist, capitalist scum who created the regulatory and welfare states in America just to bribe and confuse the American people into thinking that the government was somehow protecting the people from the people who created the state in the first place?
Well, Scott, one of the things that we deal with here is the mischievous misidentification of some people as conservatives. It's being done primarily right now by people who are in the pay or at least in the orbit of the Republican hierarchy. I mean, if you go way back to the founding Republican president, Abraham Lincoln, you had really the embryonic stage of what would be considered now a type of corporate state. He was somebody who was an attorney representing railroad interests back in the 1850s before he became a serious candidate for president. And you had a couple of free market attempts to create railways. What they would do at the time, as I think we've discussed before, Scott, when they were dealing with the complication of Indians who lived on lands that they wanted to run railroads through, they would make deals with the Indians and buy or trade for the land. Whereas, on the other hand, when you had some of these federally supported railroad initiatives, they would simply send in the army to expropriate the Indians through annihilation if nothing else proved to be availing, which is how you had Sheridan and Sherman and other people whose names I usually pronounce only after spitting. Would send in the cavalry saying the only good Indian is a dead Indian. We have to wipe them out down to the last woman and child.
Yeah, you know, nits make lice.
Exactly. Nits make lice was one of the refrains. It was Sherman who wrote the only good Indian is dead Indian. They had, of course, sharpened their fangs on the flesh of Southerners during the war between the states, and then they redirected their efforts on behalf of the same Leviathan, the same emerging corporate estate, by taking after the Plains Indians. And the rest, of course, is really bad and heartbreaking history. But you go a few decades later and you have the so-called progressive movement, which was something that gestated, I think, in equal parts on the movement left, you know, the Bellamy's of the world, the fellow who composed the Pledge of Allegiance was the brother of Edward Bellamy. Edward Bellamy was somebody who believed in creating a centralized, what he called nationalist regime in the United States that would be recognizably socialist and utopian in nature. You know, you had that faction sort of leading into the progressive movement. That's a heritage Hillary Clinton is proud to claim, by the way. She was asked about her political philosophy in a recent so-called debate, and she said, no, I wouldn't call myself a liberal, because liberals historically are people who believe in minimal government and individual rights, whereas I consider myself more of a progressive. That was a very important admission by Hillary Clinton. She was laying claim to this element of our political establishment's heritage.
It's amazing when they talk that way, isn't it? I just love it.
It really is.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Please
no,
go.
No, that's okay. on the other head of this hydra, if you will, this creature, was represented by Teddy Roosevelt, who I think was certifiably insane. He's somebody the Republicans like to claim as their own. He was, of course, kindred to FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. But he believed in busting the trusts on the assumption that, once again, these large private corporate entities have too much power and they're able to create dislocations in the market. So obviously the thing to do is to use that element of society that is completely immune to the market, which is the government, and bust up these private entities, thereby creating a larger and more monopolistic government. I don't know how the logic makes any sense, but that more or less was the position that Teddy Roosevelt espoused.
Well, here's the logic. The logic is, and that government monopoly is controlled by the people in the democracy through our vote.
Mm-hmm. Yes, better living through coercion. Mm-hmm. I mean, that more or less is the unfortunate credo of the statist left. I'm still looking for an anti-statist left. I don't know if such a thing can exist, but if it can exist, I'd sure like to find it. People on the left generally seem to think that in this corrupt fusion of corporations with government power, it is the former that is the senior partner and the corrupting element. And the problem is that a corporation, absent the cooperation of government in some way, cannot compel anybody to do anything. It certainly cannot compel people to consume their products or to take their services or to pay to capitalize their undertakings. This has to be done through coercion. Coercion is the defining attribute of government. I remember about 12 years ago, I was in Copenhagen covering a UN conference, and I had the opportunity very briefly to corner and question Bella Abzug, the late unlamented grand dame of the most Marxist element of the feminist movement. And she was giving forth in her lecture about how we needed some kind of an international version of what had happened under the progressives in the United States back in the early 20th, late 19th century, in order to combat today's economic royalists. And the question I had of Abzug was, does your foundation get any money from economic royalists? And she said, no, we get our money from foundations in the government. And I said, how are these not economic royalists? I mean, the people who built the foundations are those corporate interests that had cuddled up to the government on the one hand. And, of course, the government is nothing if not royalist, unless, of course, it's outright authoritarian or dictatorial. A royalist government is actually a more innocuous form of that affliction than a dictatorship or even a mass democracy where there is no limit through the law to what government can do. But that, I think, represents the type of myopia you're describing here, Scott, in that as long as this was funneled through some kind of a certifiably left-wing institution like Bella Abzug, I think it was called WEDU, the Women's Economic Development Organization, as long as it's funneled through that kind of an entity, it really shouldn't be considered the product of economic royalism, when actually it is, I think, the purest form of what they're talking about here in terms of the corruption that is attendant to politicized corporate wealth. But unfortunately, once again, the assumption on the part of many leftists, their basic premise, the first term of their worldview, is that somehow if the state is involved to that extent, if the state is involved in some kind of an enterprise to that extent, that enterprise is sanctified because the state represents something which is better and purer than private undertakings. And the only magical element I can isolate here that would distinguish the state is coercion. So really, when you think about it, once again, their worldview is that coercion is the key to better living.
Yeah, and you know, for the leftists who mean well, which I guess is 99% of them,
yeah.
But the ones who are on the far left, who actually, you know, tend toward Marxism and so forth. I mean, the whole theory there is that the only reason that we have the tyranny of private property is because of the socialist state that everyone's forced to pay for that protects the private property tyranny of, you know, the evil patriarchs and yada yada like that. But, you know, my argument is, if that's really the case, if you really believe that, well, then what you really want is to wither away the state so
yeah.
that it can no longer prop up that private property. The idea that somehow creating a dictatorship of the right people means that the next step after that dictatorship will be a communist paradise without a state,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't make any sense at all. If you really want to wither the state away, wither the state away.
Sure.
Stop asking them to be your best friend, for Christ's sake.
Exactly. I think that one of the problems here, and this is something that you run into, of course, and you've run into it, and I've run into it, anybody who discusses politics with people who start from a left-wing perspective on these issues, is that they assume that they will be among the anointed few, or at least people who are very close to them and solicitous of their specific interests will be among the anointed few, who will manage our affairs during that supposedly brief interregnum between things as they are right now and the prelapsarian communist paradise that's going to be restored
yeah.
at some time in the indefinite future. And so every entrenchment of the state, and this is something, of course, Orwell in Animal Farm satirizes brilliantly, every entrenchment of the state, every enrichment of its powers to coerce and to immiserate others is seen as a temporary expedient. And there is nothing more permanent than a temporary accumulation of power by government. And it doesn't matter whether you're talking about a Marxist regime or the type of robber state that you have in post-Soviet Russia right now, where you have the same people, the same nomenclatura running things, divested of the ideology and the language and ritual of the Soviet state, the same people are still running things in Russia. And whether you're talking about the Homeland Security regime that's being fastened down on us right now here in the United States, all these things are merely temporary expedients, like the telephone tax that went into effect in 1898 during the Spanish-American War, which was repealed, what was it, 3 or 4 years ago, and then mutated into something else. I mean, that's the sort of thing that achieves, as Ronald Reagan once famously said, and oh, that he had been faithful to his professed convictions. Ronald Reagan once said that the closest thing to immortality is a temporary government program. And look at the withholding tax, you know, that began as a wartime expedient in World War II. But the idea is that these things are all temporary, and that at some unspecified time, either normalcy will be restored, or something much better will be given to us. I mean, George W. Bush professes to believe, who knows whether he actually believes it or not, that by this strenuous exertion of generational war, we're going to rid the world of evil, in this case, the unspecified, conveniently non-denominational scourge of terrorism, which Bush wants us to believe is something that we can defeat through the use of terror, you know, through the use of such things as dropping 10,000-pound bombs on residential neighborhoods in Baghdad, which is a pretty good definition of terror. Or Dick Cheney would have us believe that the key to fighting terror is to launch a preemptive nuclear attack on Tehran. You know, but by doing this, by this one grand exception to what it is that we seek to create, we can create this beautiful paradisiacal world, which, of course, is not going to happen because, as I believe as Huxley once said, the means we employ are the ends in the making.
Right.
And if you use terror, what you end up with is terror. You know, Orwell said the same thing. You know, the purpose of terror is terror. The purpose of torture is torture.
Well, and it seems like that fascist state that we started the interview describing is really mostly a result of the foreign policy coming home, right? That's what they call it, the war at home. I can't get the image out of my head. I don't know if you saw Spike Lee's documentary that he did for HBO about Hurricane Katrina, but there's this great clip of the guys patrolling around New Orleans, just fresh back from Iraq with their M16s out the, you know, hanging out and all
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this there's a general, I believe he was a general, an old black guy, probably 50, 60 years old,
mm-hmm.
and he's standing in the middle of the street, and he's screaming at these guardsmen, "You put those rifles down. You
that.
Point those rifles at the ground, son. What the hell do you think you're doing?" And these soldiers, for all they know, they're still in Fallujah. There's no difference to them. They can't do the differentiation. And it's this one sober-minded commander, because of his personality in this one case, he's saying, hey, what? No. Stop your aggressive posture right now. But, you know, these are guys just back from the foreign war that we shouldn't be fighting.
Well, you know, what's even more sobering, you probably read that book, whose name escapes me right now, that was written by an embedded reporter from Rolling Stone who spent quite a time over in combat with a Marine combat unit in Iraq. And one of the things that he pointed out, it'll come to me in a second, I can't remember the name of the book had Captain America in the title, but it was about these people who had enlisted in the Marines, many of them, most of them from very troubled backgrounds, broken homes. Some of them had problems with drug use and alcohol use and things like this as teenagers. But they were very, very efficient in what they did. They were very good when it was called Generation Kill. That's the name of the book. But he, in that book, recounts an encounter between this Marine detachment and a detachment of reserves. These reservists have been drawn from, guess what? State police, local National Guard units, people had been in the local National Guard, gone into the local police, and then from there gone into the reserves and gotten sent to combat duty overseas. But by and large, they're taken from the same people who are patrolling the streets of the United States in peacetime. And what they found out, this Marine unit and this reporter, was that this particular unit of reservists had gone completely nuts. They were shooting up people with gleeful abandon. They were bombing around very conspicuously in large vehicles that had been disfigured with all kinds of aggressive graffiti that evinced their determination basically to impose their will by terrorizing people into submission, that made all kinds of trouble for the people who were the professional military in that region of Iraq. Precisely because they were more aggressive and they were less discriminating when they would mount a combat operation. They would kill civilians with impunity and without so much as a second thought. These are people who in peacetime here in the United States are law enforcement officers. That's the type of attitude they took to the battlefield with them. They took it to Iraq from the United States. Once again, is a really sobering indication of just how low we have descended here in our course into abject despotism. The professional military, the people who come back with all kinds of problematic attitudes that they were sent into a post-Katrina-type situation, were actually more restrained and rational than the law enforcement officers who, in the context of the battlefield, were given free rein to express their violent impulses. That's a scary thing.
I've said it before, and I'll say it again. At least for this generation, it was Waco that opened the gate.
Yeah.
The American people loved the Waco massacre. They thought it was the coolest thing that finally the government went and killed all those people so they didn't have to have their soap operas interrupted anymore and let them all burn in hell, too. And when the police across the country and the military, especially the federal police, when they saw that, good. The American people love it. It's been a steady dose of nothing but Memphis SWAT
and Dallas SWAT
on A&E ever since. The American people love it. The toys at the store, the Cobra Commander guy is now the local sheriff.
I know. Did you happen to see Rush Limbaugh's reaction to Waco?
Actually, no.
He had one reaction to Waco of which I am aware, and that was on his short live television program the evening of the final massacre, April 19, 1993, when he was looking at what happened. He played the clips, the infamous clips of that church. It wasn't a compound, it was a church. It was a sanctuary in a residential building on fire. Rush Limbaugh reacted by putting up what we now call a Photoshop picture of Janet Reno in a tank wearing a combat helmet saying, "Why doesn't Bill Clinton deploy her to solve the mess in Bosnia?" That was Rush Limbaugh's reaction.
Yeah.
His reaction was
celebrate
not...
Celebrate Reno.
Exactly. Celebrate Reno. To that extent, anyway, obviously she's somebody who has this to commend her. She's very good at killing civilians, so let's use her to solve the mess in the Balkans.
Man. See, I would like to think that that's just, you know, George Carlin pretend nihilism, but no, he really meant it.
Yeah. You remember the famous line that Gary Trudeau got off at Rush Limbaugh's expense about what's the difference between Rush Limbaugh and the Hindenburg. You know, one's a flaming Nazi gas bag and the other's a blimp.
That would probably be the best thing Trudeau ever wrote.
I think
that
so.
I've ever heard of. Oh, man. So we don't have enough time for this at all, but I'm going to ask you anyway. I don't know anything about this, and I'm sure that you do. Tell me about the North American Union. Is this a real deal that they're trying to push for Continental Union? Hey, I'll tell you a funny anecdote, Will,
sure.
before you answer. Let's see. It's 2007. So I guess it was about 10 years ago. I saw Mikhail Gorbachev give a speech at George Washington University, and, you know, they loved him a lot more than George Washington, no doubt about that,
no
all
doubt,
the little
yeah,
commie
yeah.
grad students there. But the speech was, of course, through his translator, about how, well, we're going to have world federalism one way or another, but unfortunately there are a lot of reactionary types around the world, and so there are going to be difficulties. But as we move toward world federalism, we may there are a few different options we could take, and one of them would be Continental Union first,
mm-hmm.
into, you know, larger and larger regional groups, and then merge those together. But I have to say, as I've seen this, you know, policy laid out, at least as to be planned, I've also seen it thwarted. The free trade of the Americas was supposed to be done all the way down to the tip of Argentina by 2005,
mm-hmm.
and that surely hasn't happened, although
no.
it seems like they're moving towards Continental Union in Latin America anyway, apart from the North American Union. But the reason I'm so curious about this is because it seems like Dick Cheney's policy has really been against what the typical so-called realist liberal internationalist Council on Foreign Relations crowd would want. And I wonder if you think he and George Bush, his junior, are actually pushing toward literally erasing the borders between Canada and Mexico that keep their governments out of our territory and our government out of theirs.
Yeah, I do think that what we're seeing on the part of the Bush administration's policy does envision the consolidation of at least some elements of the executive branch of the United States government with its counterparts in Mexico and in Canada. And they're already treating the border between the United States and Mexico as fiction for the purposes of government policy, if not necessarily for the purposes of the free movement of goods, services, and people. The latter is always the bait that's put on the hook of political consolidation. The examples we saw, for instance, in Europe during the build-up to the creation of the European Union always involved the redefinition of national boundaries and other elements of national sovereignty as impediments to free trade, when the people who were involved in this don't believe in free trade to begin with. They do not believe in the mutually beneficial exchange of goods and services between people without government intervention, which is what free trade is, whether you're talking about free trade within a community or free trade internationally. It's an exchange, an economic exchange that's not filtered through government, and government only serves as an umpire to make sure that neither force nor fraud is used in that transaction. What's happening with North American integration, there's no way of getting away from it. If you read the actual literature that's put out by people like Robert Pastor and people like Dick Cheney, who has been very candid in some circumstances talking about promoting this agenda of political integration, there's just no way getting away from the fact that we're seeing in our hemisphere something that parallels what happened in Europe. And in South America, it's run into some obstruction because Mercosur is pursuing its own agenda, which is more overtly socialist than the corporatist elements that we're seeing drive the process from North America and Central America as well. And so presumably the only thing that really is throwing up much of an obstruction to the consolidation of the hemisphere would be this dissonance between two brands of collectivism. You've got the corporatist, more fascist elements here in North America, and you've got the more populist Marxist version that you're seeing in South America. And they've not been able to reconcile those two versions, and that's what's holding up the grand design. But there really aren't impediments of that sort on a similar level between the United States and Mexico. Interestingly enough, Canada has started to get crosswise with Washington over claims to Arctic sea lanes. You see where there's this resource rush underway where the United States and Canada, Greenland, Denmark, and of course Russia are all trying to lay claims to some of the mineral-rich elements of the Arctic. And this has created some tension between Ottawa and Washington, because this is sort of ironic. There's a particular sea lane, I can't remember where it's located exactly, it's up in the Arctic waters, that Canada claims as its own territory, and it has a pretty convincing claim to it. The Bush administration, on the other hand, is saying we need to internationalize that particular channel, that particular waterway. And anytime the Bush administration is invoking international standards, of course, it's seeking to use them to advance the interests of its own clique. I mean, that's what happened with the war in Iraq. Suddenly, the Bush administration is talking about the sanctity of UN Security Council resolutions that are supposedly being violated by Saddam Hussein. And because these are supposedly being violated by Saddam Hussein, Bush has the solemn responsibility to use our military to carry out these covenantal decrees by the Security Council. Of course, when there are other resolutions the Bush administration doesn't like, they're not nearly as diligent in carrying them out. But the fact is, we've got a similar situation here. Suddenly, the Bush administration is speaking the language of internationalism, not all that different from what you find in the so-called Law of the Sea Convention. We want to internationalize these waterways as a way, presumably, of making them available to the same corporatist interests here in the United States that have been benefiting from so many other things that the Bush administration has done. And you have Canada talking the language of territorial integrity. And that is one of the type of issues. That's a representative of the type of issues that might, you know, throw some sand into the gears of consolidation between the United States and Canada. Mm-hmm. And there are other issues, of course, outstanding between Washington and Mexico City. But any way you look at it, if you take away some of what I consider to be exaggerated concerns, for instance, about the type of highways being constructed. My problem is not that there are highways being constructed. My problem is that they're all part of the same corporate structure we're talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, you're talking about something which is being politicized. That's my chief concern. Take that out of the equation. You still have an unmistakable drive to amalgamate the worst element of these three governments, which is the executive branch of all three of them. And from that arrangement, no good can come.
Right. And I guess, you know, when you talk about that example in Canada, it makes me think that a lot of the hype on the right that, you know, this is the you know, New World Order takeover of America, they really kind of got it inside out. This is America's takeover of Canada and Mexico.
This is the American political elite's takeover of the hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the same people have been causing unfiltered misery for decades are now expanding their reach in ways that are going to have a really bad impact on people outside of our borders. I mean, if you want to see the benevolent handiwork of the American political elite, go to an Indian reservation sometime and take a look at how those conquered peoples have been treated. You know, that's more or less the life that they have envisioned for the rest of us.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I'll tell you, and there's one kind of shining silver lining to all this, and that is that, you know, I guess like Princess Leia said it, the more you tighten your grip, the more will slip through your fingers.
Yeah.
And this whole Ron Paul revolution thing is taking off, and even if he gets last place in all the primaries, which I know he won't, this will still be the most people to learn about the dangers of this corporatist fascist structure that you're talking about.
Yeah.
From a free market point of view, from the real opposite point of view of fascism.
Exactly, and the really glorious thing about it is that it's trans-ideological. You've got people who have been involved in utterly disparate political undertakings who are uniting behind this campaign, and as Ron Paul says, it's not about him. He just happens to be somebody who has embraced these principles, the principles that matter. He takes himself almost entirely out of the story, which is how a statesman would handle this. I mean, he's somebody who's inexplicable in contemporary terms because he's an actual statesman. He wants to submerge himself in the actual principles of the issues that matter here. But a lot of people who had nothing to do with each other are being brought together on the common ground of freedom, which is probably the most encouraging and hopeful development that I've seen in my lifetime.
Yep, I'm really enjoying it down here, I'll tell you, and especially as we march to war with Iran, which will be the topic of our next guest, Wayne White, here after this short break. I'm damn near despair, knowing how powerless I am to do anything about the march toward disaster going on, and yet every day I can click on the Lou Rockwell blog and see something to give me some hope. So
exactly.
All right, William Norman Grigg, you're awesome. The website is the Right Source Online.
Yeah, Right Source Online, not the rightsourceonline.com.
I always screw that up. And
that's
I know this one. It's freedominourtime.blogspot.com, pro libertate. Thanks very much for your time, Will.
Thanks so much, Scott.
Now. congregation.
Politics who robbing hold down your zone.
So those who give the thieves the key to their homes.
The pig whose feet are more than one shall clap.
What survivors who make a move in more than one?
All right, folks, welcome back to Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and man, I'm sorry. I know Rage is all played out and everybody hates that shit, but I thought it was the one where he says, there's a mass without roofs, there's a prison to fill, and but it wasn't. But anyway, that one's pretty good, too, though. Those that give the thieves the key to their homes, I like that. And I like that. So, postscript to the Will Grigg interview there from Wired on the 29th. Point, click, eavesdrop. How the FBI wiretap net operates. The FBI, this is by Ryan Singel. The FBI has quietly built a sophisticated point-and-click surveillance system that performs instant wiretaps on almost any communications device, according to nearly 1,000 pages of restricted documents newly released under the Freedom of Information Act. The surveillance system, called DCSNet, for Digital Collection System Network, connects FBI wiretapping rooms to switches controlled by traditional landline operators, internet telephony providers, and cellular companies. It is far more intricately woven into the nation's telecom infrastructure than observers suspected. Some observers, you mean to say, because, of course, I've been telling you on, well, I'd like to say these airwaves, but chaos isn't even on the air. Thanks to some people. I mean, no thanks to some people. But anyway, on chaos airwaves, I've been trying to explain to you guys for years and years that the entire modern telecommunications system in this country is built with the NSA from the ground up, that they have access to everything, you know. I've known this for years and years. I don't even remember where I've learned it. I've talked to people who owned, actually, I've talked to people who owned telecommunications companies who told me this back in ye old last American century. But anyway, so this is the deal. The DCS 3000 client, also known as Red Hook, handles pen registers and tap and traces, a type of surveillance that collects signaling information, primarily the numbers dialed from a telephone, but no communications content. The DCS 6000, known as Digital Storm, captures and collects the content of phone calls and text messages for full wiretap orders. A third classified system, the DCS 5000, is used for wiretaps targeting spies or terrorists. I guess that means by definition that the other ones aren't. Sounds like. And anyway, this is a great article. Four full pages here printed out on about a medium text size. It's from Wired.com by Ryan Singel. Singel? Something. Point, click, eavesdrop. How the FBI wiretap net operates. Very interesting stuff. Urge y'all to look it up. And maybe I'll try to see if I can arrange an interview with this guy to explain in an actual learned fashion, rather than my off-the-cuff one. So this is Anti-War Radio, and of course, the only thing that matters in the world right now is debunking the lies that are leading us towards war with Iran. And we're going to listen to some music here for a second. And when we come back, Wayne White, the former deputy director, of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia, will be on the show to help us do just that. So, once you guys stay tuned, you're listening to Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas.
Chaos Radio. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. Right now, what we do. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. When they can't do it themselves. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. Way up high, up your, up you. Try to stop us, it's of you. The society's out of control. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. Make this smart, can't think themselves. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. Laugh at us, they hide our back. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. High five, satisfaction, what they lack. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. We are tired of your abuse. Try to stop us, but it's no use. Our time of your abuse. Try to stop us, it's no use. We're born with a chance. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. I am gonna have my chance. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. We are born with a chance. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. And I am gonna have my chance. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. We are God. Rise above, rise above, rise above, we're gonna rise above, we're gonna rise above, we're gonna rise above.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton, and my next guest today is Wayne White. He's the former Deputy Director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia and adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute. Welcome back to the show, Wayne.
My pleasure.
Good to talk with you again, sir. And there's been a lot of bad news coming out over the last week. It looks like the propaganda campaign against Iran is really heating up, and again, you're the most optimistic source I can find who's actually paying attention to the same facts I am, and you're telling me, at least give me a little bit of breathing room, it feels like, that we're probably not talking about anything in the next few weeks because the Air Force likes to fight at night.
Yeah, I'd hardly consider that optimistic in view of my fears, very, very serious concerns that the administration has not passed up the military option. I think it's very much on the table, just like they say. And I think something else has been exaggerated even more generally in official Washington, but relates to this, and that is that Condi Rice, you know, this premise that Condi Rice has established a more pragmatic approach toward various problems out there, but particularly the Iranian nuclear enrichment issue, and that the Cheney people are fading in the face of this wave of pragmatism. And frankly, I don't see that. In fact, the negotiating track that's often cited to justify believing that this is something happening out there is really a very shaky read, you know, to base anything on, because these rather one-dimensional chats with the Iranians only about Iraq, when the Iranians clearly want to talk about a lot, are just doomed to failure. And we've seen what they comprise, mainly our ambassador blaming the Iranians for various things, and then the Iranians denying it. And so that doesn't get you very far.
Yeah, well, it seems like the Condi Rice angle is just really laying the groundwork for Cheney's solution, which is bomb them back to the Stone Age, and he gets to point at Condoleezza Rice and say, look, we gave her all the time in the world. We tried every diplomatic means we could to get them to bend to our will, and they won't, so now we're forced to do this.
Exactly. This is why I think that far from being contradictory, one could play right into the other, despite the fact that there may very well be people who are alarmed by the potential consequences of all this, even maybe Condi Rice herself. That doesn't mean that she's butting her head up against, the vice president.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, in fact, I think the last time we spoke was back in February, and what was going on there was they were just beginning to debut this completely false propaganda about Iran being behind all the new bombs killing our guys in Iraq. And if you remember,
I don't think it's completely false.
Well, hold that one.
There's a lot of evidence out there, and there are a lot of
bloody-minded characters in the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Quds Force.
Okay,
and
well, I'm not so sure
it's not happening, but on the other hand, it doesn't warrant a war.
Okay, well, hang on with the EFPs, because we got time. But on the Rice issue, in terms of the diplomats versus the vice president's office, at that time, it was reported, I believe it was the L.A. Times, back then, 8 months, 7, 8 months ago, that they had a plan that was drawn up, I think, in the Pentagon or by the National Security Council to come out and say this is all the evidence of the EFPs, and that Condoleezza Rice and Robert Gates had balked and said, no, take it back to the kitchen and tighten up the accusations a little bit because this is going too far. And I guess the perception at the time was that, as Gareth Porter has explained, Rice was, trying to avert the war, but going along with the turn of the accusations of the EFPs in order to try to force Iran to negotiate. So it was basically her interests and the vice president's interests converging there, but they had different purposes. She was trying to avert the war, and he was trying to create an excuse for one.
Yeah, quite possibly. And the way the propaganda surrounding, or what should I say, the attention surrounding the issue of the EFPs and other clandestine Iranian activities in Iraq is heating up, would suggest that at the very least we're entering a period in which some sort of retaliatory action along the border, could very well occur. Sort of along the lines of airstrikes a few miles in against suspected Quds Force positions or what have you. And some people actually fear that that would then become something that would engender then an Iranian retaliation, which would get us, more and more of an excuse to go larger, mm-hmm. With respect to what's done in Iran. I don't know whether that's true or not, but what I do worry about is the rising tension given to the Iranians, what they're doing, as if plans are being laid for some kind of retaliation along the border, which would be very easy, to do,
Well, and McClatchy newspapers reported not too long ago, and I guess The Guardian followed up, or maybe it was the other way around, that Cheney was advocating strikes against Revolutionary Guard targets in Iran, and that came relatively, I guess, on the heels of Steve Clemens' report that I think it was Woomser had been sent, or the Times later fingered Woomser, but Clemens reported that one of Cheney's minions was going around and telling the guys at AEI that he was determined, if necessary, to do an end run around George Bush to get the war started. And then once the bombing starts, then it's just a matter of escalating to the full-scale bombing campaign that he really wants.
Yeah, well, it'd be even almost hard to talk about end running the president, which is pretty hard. Because I think the president has pretty strong views on these issues himself. Mm-hmm. The president, takes extremely seriously this notion of the Iranian nuclear program posing an existential threat to Israel. I happen to be one of these bizarre individuals who believes that Iran probably does have a nuclear weapons program, but that we should not engage in military action because the monstrous crisis relating to military action would greatly overshadow what would happen if Iran, 7, 8, 9, 10 years from now enters the nuclear club. Because what Iran really wants is a deterrent from the very thing that you and I are talking about today. And it would be supremely ironic if, in therefore trying to gain the deterrent, the Iranians trigger the attack that they're trying to prevent. But I really do not think they intend to do anything with what they acquire. And unfortunately, a very weak president, but who has a bully pulpit, Ahmadinejad, has been feeding the international media the kind of grist that everyone wants, who is a hawk on this issue, even though, again, he has very little power and would never have his button on, any nuclear device.
Well, now, I think you're the most credible source I've ever heard say that they thought that there was a nuclear weapons program in Iran. I'm interested to know what your best indications of that are. George Bush himself just has said 2 or 3 times in the last couple of weeks that the fear is that the program that we all know they have might one day be used to develop a nuclear weapons program that then might be able to make a bomb. So it sounds like you're more convinced that they have a some sort of secret program than the president, Wayne.
I don't know about that. But Iran lives in a very dangerous neighborhood. There have been evasions associated with her relationship with the IAEA, which are suspicious. And one of them actually has been resolved, and that was the issue of plutonium hemispheres, which seemed very suggestive before. But I have a relative who actually is a nuclear engineer and who knows very little about the Iranian issue, and I sent him several hundred pages of what I could send him, you know, now that I'm out of government, on the program. And in some cases, that's very detailed IAEA reports. And it was funny. I asked him, I said, does this look like an unbalanced program that might have a weapons option, or does this look like sort of a standard, you know, initial program to produce a number of options for nuclear power? And he has some experience in at least one developing world program. And he came back, spent weeks looking over this stuff, and he came back to me and he said, I think they're going for a bomb. And I said, why? And he said, the heavy water production, just to cite one thing that, you know, is being ramped up for here and planned, he says, is way out of balance with the amount of heavy water that would be needed to support a civilian reactor program. And since then, I was in touch with a think tank that works with the UN on certain issues, and they said we'd picked up on the exact same thing.
Oh, that's interesting. I'll have to run that by Dr. Prather, our nuclear expert over at antiwar.com. He spent his career making bombs.
It's an interesting angle that hadn't occurred to me. He literally said it was vastly more than should be needed by this sort of a program.
Very interesting.
In other words, he was talking like in factors of like 10 times more, this kind of stuff.
Well, now, the other thing, though, about the Iranian nuclear program, well, there's a couple of things here. I mean, what we are talking about is the program that they do have above board that is monitored by the IAEA. So they would have to withdraw from the NPT and kick the IAEA out before they actually tried to really start making bombs. And then Also, I keep reading that all they have is a bunch of junk that they got from AQ Khan's garage sale, that they've got, they were supposed to have thousands and thousands of centrifuges running by now, but they have 600 and something, and they can barely get the stuff to enrich to 3.5%. And it seems to me like I'm really
report,
not scared.
The report that just came out of the IAEA appeared to confirm that they have 2,000 currently functioning.
We're
trying to bring 600 more online.
Oh, I could swear. I just read in the International Herald Tribune.
That's what I thought I read anyway.
Well, yeah, we'll have to go back and check footnotes there, Wayne. But I don't know. It just seems, well, like the plutonium issue, and again, I don't know any. I've never worked for anybody's intelligence agency, and most of my best information comes from Scott Ritter's book, Target Iran, and from reading and talking with Dr. Gordon Prather. But
I frankly would not have very much in the way of nuclear knowledge myself if I hadn't been a rock analyst for the department, you know, between 1979 and 86, and had to follow in great detail the Tuwaitha facility and Iraq, you know, weapons issues. And then the thing that is amazing that, well, people constantly use the analogy in order to argue what you're arguing, that Iran doesn't have a weapons program because it sort of falls in line with the exaggeration of the evidence before the 2003 war in Iraq on WMD. But the analogy that's relevant is what they found in Iraq after 1991, in which Iraq had a relationship with the IAEA, and people were astounded, international inspectors as well as UNSCOM, at how far Iraq had gotten toward a nuclear device clandestinely. In other words, the lack of intelligence was actually ended up being the opposite of what one would assume. So there are some quirky cases out there that need to be watched. But nonetheless, again, regardless of what's going on there, I'm sorry. I do not think starting a massive crisis in the Persian Gulf, one that could overshadow Iraq, if that can be believed, which could also help further destabilize Iraq, and which could send global energy markets into an incredible spiral at a time when the United States, by the way, is having some significant financial problems, is a very bad idea, all based on the assumption that Iran can't wait to hurl bombs at Israel, which I would think the rather comfortable mullahs ruling Iran with their great financial empires and everything would find very, very distressing, considering they would have to expect a massive return strike from an extremely, you know, sophisticated nuclear power.
Yeah, well, I guess there's a few different directions. I want to get back to the EFPs as another not good enough excuse for war, even if it's true kind of thing. But let's focus more on the consequences, possible consequences. We talked before about sort of the premises that they're going to sit there and let us bomb them for a couple of weeks, and then we're going to tell them the war's over, and they're supposed to go along with that. And that's not how wars work. You're an expert on this region. Do you have a domino theory? Are you worried that if we start bombing Iran, that this could lead to instability in Pakistan and Afghanistan and countries the other stands north of Iran, Russia, China's interests get involved here. Any kinds of I want to hear the possible consequences other than oil's going to be more expensive and the one that we cover every day on this show, which is that our guys in Iraq are going to be subject to being shot in the back by the Shia militias they've been training and arming all this time.
One thing that we have to keep in mind is duration. This is perhaps one of the most unnerving things for me about all this. The last person who decided to take a whack at the Iranians big time and also was deluded into thinking that such a whack might even bring regime change in Tehran was none other than Saddam Hussein, the man who occupied the same real estate we do out there right now. And he ended up in an 8-year war that killed or maimed 200,000 Iraqis, not to mention the million Iranians, who died in it. But the million Iranians is very suggestive, because it shows that the Iranians are willing to make vast sacrifices to pay you back for what you do in this context. And so there are a lot of possibilities out there, all the way from activating Hezbollah in Lebanon to retaliate against the Israelis, who would be presumed to have had something to do with this, even if it was just encouraging us, to say the least. Through Iraq, where there could be retaliation on the ground, and by the way, during a conflict, because even if you are bombing the Iranians day after day after day after day and trying to take out their various anti-ship missiles in the Gulf, air assets and things like that to make the Gulf retaliation less distressing, the Iranians are not stupid. And they would be basically firing what they didn't lose the day before into the Gulf if they were in that use or lose situation. And then for years afterward, you could have a simmering low-level conflict going on with the Iranians poking out this way and that against us. That's probably what I fear most about this. No end game. And there would be no regime change in Tehran after something like this. If anything, the current regime would be strengthened, as even probably a lot of reformists swallowed very hard and shouldered up to the current regime, as the only thing representing Iran right now, and therefore we better support our government. It's a very, very nightmarish scenario in terms of how do you put an end to it. It almost mirrors the issue of the 2003 war against Iraq, which is, now that we're in Baghdad, what do we do? And we know what happened as a result of that lack of planning.
Well, I hate to be this cynical or conspiratorial in my thinking and so forth, but maybe this is George Bush and Dick Cheney's last chance for national greatness. After all, Woodrow Wilson got 100,000 killed. Why not go ahead and start a full-scale war and an occupation and a draft and turn this thing into a big giant hullabaloo so that he can go down in history like Truman and Lincoln and all his heroes, Theodore Roosevelt and so forth. There have been at least two different reports I've seen from two different sources talking about contractors getting phone calls saying, hey, what do you think it would cost to set up shop in Iran? And as though they're planning for an actual ground invasion, occupation, regime change disaster a la Iraq, only on a much larger scale.
Yeah, it's almost incredible to, believe this, that people could delude themselves that vastly, considering our ground forces are so utterly stretched they can barely maintain themselves in Iraq, let alone going somewhere else.
So you're telling me I'm crazy or Cheney's crazy?
I haven't a clue on that one. All I know is anyone who thinks they're going to be setting up shop in Tehran had better be ready for the death penalty, because I think the current regime will be still in charge, and you won't make it 10 clicks into the country before you lose your head after that kind of an attack.
It's strange. I am hearing kind of two different versions coming from different angles about what's headed. When we talked a few months back, you talked about the plans. You've seen the war plans. Again, I'm talking with Wayne White, former deputy director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia Division. You'd seen the war plans. They called for 700 targets, approximately 1,500 sorties for redundancy to make sure to get those. And then I guess you've seen this report by these British scholars that have come out.
Oh, my God, yes.
And they're predicting an absolute full-scale war. They say 10,000 targets, which if it takes 1,500 sorties to get 700 targets, then somebody help me do the math. How many sorties is that to get 10,000
targets? Their statement is that the weaponry has become so advanced hold your tongue, because you may want to laugh over this one, that those 10,000 targets can be taken out quite easily. With not nearly the number of combat sorties that you think.
Oh, yeah,
you
just
know,
like Doha Farms.
People I know, have considerable military expertise and have served in the military, Pat Lang and others, think this is absolute poppycock. No, you would probably have, if you're going after 10,000 targets, you would have weeks in order to try to take out that kind of thing. And then, of course, if you're thinking of regime change and you expand the target set, you know, beyond Iran's nuclear infrastructure and the possible ways in which Iran might retaliate, to include her economic base, communications, and things like that. Well, now you've just given even more reason for every Iranian to stand up and scream loyalty to the current regime and revenge against the United States one way or another, even if it has to come 5 years from now. It's really very, very strange.
Well, let me ask you about this. You're familiar with Ray McGovern, the former CIA analyst?
Not as much as you might think, but I know of him.
Okay, well, he gave an interview to my colleague at Anti-War Radio the other day, Charles Goyette, and basically the tone of the entire interview was, God, I hope that the Joint Chiefs of Staff refuse to obey their orders, because there is no other force in America organized to oppose this war with Iran. The Democratic Party is completely owned, apparently from top to bottom, by the War Party. They do nothing but try to outflank the Cheney regime on the right when it comes to bellicose threats against Iran. And it seems like there's nobody to stop them. I got this former CIA analyst saying, I hope the generals refuse to obey their orders.
Well, I hope he's wrong about nobody out there to stop it. I have a feeling if the president wants to do this, and he wants congressional approval to go ahead, he's going to have some problems, because I do think there are people who will have some qualms about all of this. But the problem is that Joint Chiefs won't disobey their orders. They will obey their orders, even though what was going on back in 2006 with respect to contingency plans suggested very strongly that the military was very much opposed to a robust campaign against Iran. The military was quite aware of the fact that they've got their hands full, and that this could be an open-ended scenario that, you know, continues on for quite some time. I think the military, in this case, will play a good role in trying to sober up the president and anyone else in the administration advocating this kind of a policy, but the only question is, will that be enough? Because if they're issued their orders, they're going to do their duty as they see it.
Right, and
unfortunately,
it has been reported that the chiefs, I forget the name of that guy in Time Magazine, it's the guy that wrote Primary Colors, Klein, right?
I think so. Yeah,
in his blog on Time Magazine's website, he talked about the Joint Chiefs taking the president into what they call the bathtub and the darkest dungeon of the Pentagon in the secure room, and that they told the president the facts of life. One, that they were opposed to the surge, and two, he better not bomb Iran. So we see how closely he's followed their advice on the first one.
Right.
But we'll see where that goes. Now, okay, let's argue about EFPs for a minute. you told me months and months ago that you have seen evidence, and Wayne, I believe you, that the Quds Force is inside Iraq. Clearly, the Iranian government has interests inside Iraq.
Oh, yeah. There can be no doubt. It was clear they were there, just as they were in Afghanistan. That doesn't tell you what they're doing exactly, they're actually very secretive, and it's hard to know what they're up to if you're out of government.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in government, and you have certain clearances, you can have access to information about the Quds Force, but obviously Iran is not advertising what it does. It is basically the dirty trick squad, for the regime, and in fact, to show you another limitation, or to show people who need to hear this, the kind of limitations that Ahmadinejad has, despite his anti-Israeli rants, the Quds Force is not in his chain of command.
Mm-hmm.
They take their orders from the supreme leader via the commander of the Revolutionary Guard. Ahmadinejad is not in that line of command.
Oh, in fact, and pardon me for going down this tangent. We can get back to the EFPs in a second. I'm so glad that you brought that up. I hear wide and disparate descriptions of this man's actual job. Now, Juan Cole told me that he's basically equivalent to our Secretary of the Interior, only with a little bit more fanfare, and that he really is not all that powerful at all. And then I hear other people say, he's the one who's going to wipe Israel off the map and all this kind of stuff. So I'm sure the truth is in there, in between somewhere. Help me out.
Yeah, it sort of is in between, although a lot closer to Juan than the other incredible.
I expected you would say that.
Yeah. We had the reformist takeover the presidency when Khatami took power as president through overwhelming election victories, and then the reformists took over the parliament. They took over the local councils, and they weren't able to change much of anything except some lifestyle issues inside of Iran, getting these people to back off from harassing people in the street for what they're wearing and what have you. As far as the basic fundamentals of this regime and how it conducts itself, such as free speech, transparency, etc., they got nowhere. And so you can see how limited the power of Ahmadinejad is now holding the exact same office. He's got some contacts in the Guard, probably among the senior leadership of the Guard. So he probably has an idea of what the Quds Force has been up to, but he doesn't technically have to be told. The interesting thing about the Guard, however, is that during the elections in which Khatami won with his reformist majorities, we received several pieces of information, and I know, this also has become common knowledge on the outside, that an overwhelming majority of the Revolutionary Guard voted for the reformists, which shows that as the Guard, sucks in more and more people, recruits, from the same population that once lifestyle loosened up, that wants more freedoms, etc., the Guard also begins to change away from what the Guard was, say, back in the 1980s when Khomeini was still alive.
Mm-hmm. And I remember it was unfortunately sad and funny at the same time. In July of 2005, after Ahmadinejad got elected, all of his campaign managers and aides and so forth came out and said, "We want to give a direct thank you to George W. Bush for running his mouth in the past 2 weeks, warning the Iranian people that they better not vote for the right winger. You got us elected, pal. Appreciate it." And they laughed. And it was, just verbal intervention in the internal affairs of that country is what helped Ahmadinejad get elected in the first place.
May well have, but I think the manipulation of the vote that got him into the runoff probably has something to do with it as well. This is a very interesting thing that you bring up, though, because so many times what this administration, which is so clueless, on what makes Iranians tick, think will help the cause of the liberals inside the country or help the cause of reform or freedom, is just the opposite. In other words, when the president, for example, made his Axis of Evil speech, back in January 2002, which is probably one of the worst presidential addresses ever, the polls in Iran, where because of the weariness because of the clerical regime they had to suffer under. The polls in Iran showed that Iranians, on average, were far more pro-American than anyone around them. In the Arab world, the figures were in the basement. The negatives were up around 90% in most Arab states. In Iran, a majority of Iranians were responding positively to polls regarding the United States until the speech.
Right.
And then following that speech, downward. Just the image of the United States among average Iranians, even reformists, has nosedived.
Yep.
And continued to nosedive. That's just the kind of foolishness, you know, that just is unappreciated by this administration.
Yeah, and those of us with C-SPAN remember that right after September 11th, they held a candlelight vigil. A million people turned out in Tehran to cry for dead Americans.
Yeah.
Well, let's just take that and throw it in the garbage. Why not? It'll probably work. Okay, now let's fight about EFPs. I've read dozens of different times, Wayne, that American soldiers have found EFP factories in Iraq. And I have no reason to believe whatsoever other than, hearing it from you, if you believe it and can provide some kind of evidence for me, that these things are coming from Iran. Anybody can make a shape charge.
Produced any evidence linking this to Iran.
That I've ever seen.
Even the discovery of weapons caches that seem to be coming from Iran.
Well, that seemed to be
in close proximity to the Iranian border, that kind of thing.
Well, you know, says Michael Gordon and General Odierno. I mean, and in fact, Odierno has backed off of a lot of these claims, at least in some circumstances. And also, correct me when I go off what's right here, but it's the only Shiite
militias.
No, nobody
knows what's right on this. Everyone's guessing. Everyone's basically sizing things up and making their own call.
Okay.
There's no right or wrong.
Well, I mean, that, you know, ought to tell us all we need to know, right? I mean, I've seen bombs laid out for pictures that look like the painting on them was done in Abe Schulsky's office. You know, it's all in English and with American-style dating. And then I hear a lot of assertions. But help me with this, though. Is it not the case that the Shiite militias who are actually resisting the Americans and killing Americans are mostly those tied with Sadr, who is the more nationalist of the leaders of the Shiite factions, whereas the Iranians have really been putting their weight behind Abdulaziz Hakim and the Supreme Islamic Council and the Dawa Party this whole time?
Well,
they're training our friends.
Well, I wouldn't say that. Exactly accurate. Is Sadr a nationalist? Absolutely, in his own way. But he has very close ties to the Iranians. When I was in government, he took money from the Iranians. The Iranians didn't like him at the beginning because he seemed so unpredictable and rash. They were more drawn to his more predictable counterparts in the Supreme Council and militias and organizations like that. But then when he became a huge phenomenon on the Iraqi scene, well, the Iranians decided to, put some money on that number as well. And the very fact that you had reports that he had fled into Iran at the time of the surge, which I never believed, I figured he went south, which was just as easy, suggested that there are a lot of people who think he has ties to Iran, or else that's the last place he'd obviously flee to. I think Sadr has ties to Iran, and the Iranians want to make sure that they have some money on that horse in case he turns out to be a populist success, which is not something to be dismissed in the crazy politics of Iraq that we have ignited.
Yeah, I mean, and I never really doubted that, he knows them, he's friends with them, that they have money and so forth. But when I read, well, for 6 months straight, I've read all this propaganda about Sadr's guys are traveling by the tens of thousands to Iran for training. Iran must be the ones who are arming and training the Mahdi army. It must be where they're getting the bombs from, etc. It seems like it's been the Hakim clan that's been much closer to the Iranians this whole time. They were in Iran during the Iran-Iraq war where the Sadrs stayed. And it seems like, they're the guys, they're the Iraqi government. And yet I'm reading in the newspaper that, oh yeah, the American battle against the Shiite insurgency, all of a sudden they just switch it. And when they do the accusations, they never outright accuse the Mahdi army or the Badr Corps. They just say Iran is backing Shiite militias, and the whole thing just seems like it's all been contrived by Wormser and Cheney, you know, locked up there at the Naval Air Station where we live.
It's all being contrived. Obviously, even you can see that Iran is backing certain militias inside of Iraq.
So, sure, it just seems to me like they're backing
they
the same ones as us.
They don't have to bother that. In fact, that's the problem with the Iranians. The Iranians make certain things happen that make it easy for people to vilify them. You know, they have been involved in terrorism around the region for a long time. People are afraid of them in the region. Americans, ever since 44 hostages were taken back in 1979, have not exactly had the Iranians on the top of their, you know, we love you list. So it's very easy to vilify Iran, even without Ahmadinejad there. But the Iranians, you know, there are a lot of things around that you'd have to go back and review. Like, for example, and just when you read too much online, I mean, in other words, like I probably read about 80 or 90 things a day, you know what it's like. There was an account, which I thought was quite credible, on the part of one of Sadr's people. He gave an interview to somebody. I'd have to do a lot of nexus searches to find it, in which he described going down to the border south of Baghdad, well south of Baghdad, and taking a delivery truckload of arms for the Mahdi army from the Iranians. And this sounded very credible to me because I did know that the Mahdi army did have some ties to Tehran. It's hard to know whether they're stronger than the ties that Tehran has to the Supreme Council. I think they're less. But it also made sense in the sense that you don't see too many Quds Force or other real Iranian troublemakers being arrested inside of Iraq. You see other Iranians being harassed. And that's because the Iranians are smart enough to keep their dirty tricks people out of Iraq. And in other words, if they're delivering arms or what have you into the border. And a friend of mine who was the CPA administrator in one of the southerly provinces knew all about Iranian gun running in those days, and it was pretty much the same then. The Iranians would, you know, basically make it available along the border, and people had to come and pick up at the supermarket. They didn't deliver in order to keep themselves out of harm's way.
So in your mind, does this make what Lieberman says true, Senator Lieberman, when he says the Iranians are already at war with us? They're killing our guys in Iraq.
War, that is. I mean, you know, it's the kind of inflammatory rhetoric that's so unhelpful. What's war? I really do not think Iran is at war with the United States. If it was, I think we'd know what war was. Iran was at war with Iraq for 8 years, and that was a hell of a fight. If we go after the Iranians, like after the nuclear targets, then we'll find out what a war with Iran means, a country of over 70 million people, three times the size of Iraq, and having a sprawling coastline on the Persian Gulf and even in the Indian Ocean. Very, very serious problem there if you go to war against a country like that.
Mm-hmm. And now, what do you make of recent statements by presidential candidates and so forth about using American soldiers to pursue al-Qaeda in Pakistan? Now, I know that the policy has been to do missile strikes in Pakistan, and Musharraf always says, oh, it was an explosion at a chemical plant or whatever to cover up for it, and that's part of the deal, is at least using missiles to strike within Pakistan. But there have been more bellicose statements by Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, for example, that suggest that they really would like some sort of invasion of Waziristan and so forth. What do you make of that?
Oh, well, it's an election season, and al-Qaeda is 100% bad. And if you step back from taking the toughest possible stance against al-Qaeda anywhere, you stand to get criticized as a presidential candidate. And so they're going to continue saying things like that. But going into Pakistan in pursuit of al-Qaeda is not only a way to get yourself in a whale of trouble with Musharraf, also, if you go in with too big a footprint, a way to lose a few prisoners, maybe al-Qaeda will, you know, be putting out a video of the execution of a few American Delta Force, you know, types who attempted it. But you know what is worst of all? A lot of people who cover Pakistan, which is riven, you know, with sectarian differences of its own, religious issues, and nationality problems related to various nationalities, fear that, you know, if the cards aren't played right, Pakistan could become a mega Lebanon, and even worse than Lebanon, a mega Lebanon with nukes. So fooling around in Afghanistan in any way that discredits its current government, although I'm not going to say that I recommend Mr. Musharraf as a, you know, particularly as president, I'm just saying that threatens central government authority and, you know, angers various sectors of the Pakistani population at a time when the government is trying to remain relatively pro-U.S. or at least cooperative with us, is a ticket to further instability in this huge, important country. And that's just the kind of fumbling around. That's just the kind of silly kind of intervention, which probably would only have a pinprick effect on al-Qaeda overall, even if you send in a few hundred people against six or seven targets, that could devastate a very large country in the Middle East, South Asia region. Very, very touchy there.
Now,
but you're not going to get people to back away from comments like that, because, again, going after al-Qaeda, there's nobody who's going to, you know, step back from that. You're supposed to be doing that all the time.
Right, and you know, you speak of this instability and tying it back to a possible war with Iran. A very prominent establishment member, Jimmy Carter's former national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, testified to the Senate about possible consequences of a war with Iran, and he ended up using language similar to, we're going to end up owning all the land between Israel and India, and we just can't do it. And, you know, it seemed like he was, you know, sort of implicit in there that, you know, the regimes in Jordan and Pakistan are weak enough that, you know, we go ahead and move toward Iran, you might as well count those guys out too.
Yeah, in fact, unfortunately, some of the government, a friend of mine who has access to some senior officials in governments in the Gulf, some of those governments, unfortunately, have actually been, or some of their officials are favorably inclined to the United States going after Iran, because they fear the Shia, you know, this tremendous Shia power gaining from what's happening in Iraq. But you're absolutely right. This is delusionary. In other words, these people, anybody who supports going after Iran like this, could find themselves in very serious trouble with respect to the bulk of their population that would react very negatively to it. Because what it does is it contributes to that image that's so damaging already out there of the United States as an anti-Muslim power, a country that no matter who it is, the Iraqis, the Iranians, Palestinians, whether they're Shia, Sunni, whatever, is anti-Muslim, mistreats Muslims in its own country, is allied to states that mistreat Muslims in Europe, and has an anti-Muslim agenda, and this is just another proof of it. And, you know, that image itself is terribly destructive throughout the entire Muslim world, and there are a billion Muslims on this planet.
Mm-hmm. I'm always interested.
Many of whom would be, of course, encouraged to join al-Qaeda and other organizations and become radicalized by moves like the U.S. Moving against Iran.
Sure, just like they did when they invaded Iraq.
Pakistan after the Taliban, or after al-Qaeda. You could actually, for every person you take out, have 20 or 30 volunteers coming forward.
Mm-hmm. Hey, you know, a former CIA guy I talked to sometimes named Phil Giraldi, I asked him what he thought the best way to fight al-Qaeda, because after all, it was bin Laden and Zawahiri and those guys who sent the guys, the Hamburg cell, to come hijack our planes and kill 3,000 people, and somebody does have to do something about them. And I asked Phil, because he's opposed to all this, you know, regime change and occupation and neoconservative policy as well. And I asked him, well, how do you fight al-Qaeda? And I believe the quote was, well, we got to ramp this whole thing down. We got to do this with intelligence, with police, with, you know, cooperation with national governments around the world, and only in the most extreme circumstances use military. And we've got to, you know, rather than the policy that, as you so accurately described, just, you know, brings more al-Qaeda guys in to replace the ones we kill, we've got to set about a policy where we're killing these guys, but they're not being replaced.
Absolutely. And no, you're right. As long as our certain aspects of our policy remain essentially militarized, you're going to have a lot of counterproductive developments. And you know, it's the kind of thing that's very frustrating for Americans, because Americans like, you know, sort of solutions that appear dramatic and decisive, And, of course, military action tends to take that form, but it can be just the worst possible thing, you know, to do in certain circumstances. In other words, do I like the fact that hundreds of Al-Qaeda and Taliban cadres are taking refuge in Waziristan and in the northwestern provinces of Pakistan? No, of course not. But if going in after them in a very, very wild-ass military fashion brings about the destabilization of one of the largest countries in between Morocco, you know, and India, just so we can knock off a few dozen of those people in that one area, I don't think that's a very good trade-off. I really don't. And nobody's really out there explaining it thoroughly to Americans what the stakes are of doing things like that. It just sounds good. Mm-hmm. It sounds like, good, we're getting them. You know, that it just appeals to that that decisive inclination on the part of so many people, and the rage, you know, that still seethes in the wake of 9/11 about Al-Qaeda and other things it's done since. But that's a way to get yourself into a whale of trouble, a lot worse than things are now, and they're bad enough now.
Now, I don't even really have time to ask this question and get an answer, but I'll go ahead and push it anyway. To what degree is your opinion, as expressed here today, indicative of a split, larger factional splits within the American establishment? I keep seeing, I believe the man's name is Edward Djerian, the president or chairman or something.
Ed Djerian.
Yeah, yeah, from the James Baker Institute in
Houston.
Yeah,
no, we used to work together. When he was ambassador in Syria, I was the senior analyst for Syria in the Department of Intelligence.
Okay. And I keep seeing him arguing with Kagan and the kooks at AEI. And I just wonder, how could it really be that the Israel lobby and the American Enterprise Institute types have been able to control the policy over what seems to be the express wishes of Houston, Texas, and the regular, you know, professional foreign policy set that you presumably represent?
I can't answer that, except that unfortunately it goes a long way back. They've got cut a deep groove into American politics, and essentially the premise, you know, that the country that matters most in the Middle East by far is Israel, despite the fact that it's rather small, and that we have vast interests, and particularly financial interests in other areas, has significantly warped, you know, policy. How to get it back under control, I don't know. It's been going on so long, the average American sort of accepts this generalization, even when they're thinking about Arab states with whom we have great relations. They think the Israelis are the good guys and the Arabs are the bad guys, or the Iranians are the bad guys, or the Muslims are the bad guys. It's very simple. It's sort of like cowboys and Indians, you know, which also was another bad stereotype.
But so I guess you didn't really correct my characterization that the Houston, Texas guys and the permanent establishment really are stuck out, frustrated, and not, they're not going along with this policy. They're just not able to stop it. Is that right?
It's deeply rooted in American political culture, and it's just simply that you'll never get a presidential candidate, you know, to take on that issue. And because they know that there's so many Americans who are essentially conditioned to believe the Israelis are the good guys, period.
Mm-hmm. So the neocons really are the establishment now.
I don't know about the neocons, because there are a lot of people who go well beyond the neocon philosophy that support Israel. In fact, way beyond the neocons who support Israel. That's the problem. It's a deeply embedded belief on the part of a vast majority of Americans, and you know that the neocons represent a rather small minority, influential, of course, but a rather small minority of the overall electorate. But this is a problem that we have never been able to get beyond. That's why we have such a mess going on in Palestine, because the United States has never, just one reason, is that the United States has never been able to play the role of a truly honest broker between the Arab states and Israel, or right now the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. And the Israelis.
And, you know, we could add to that that's what got our towers knocked down, that those hijackers and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his nephew Ramzi Youssef and all of them have cited America's one-sided support for Israel as their motivation for blowing up the World Trade Center both times.
Exactly, which is why in our deliberations in the Iraq Study Group up came the whole subject of, you know, trying to effect some kind of a fair settlement to the Israeli-Palestinian issue as rather significant. And I can remember one individual who is very conservative saying, "Well, why would that be relevant? You mean if we had a solution to the situation over in Palestine, that suddenly all the insurgents in Iraq would say, 'Oh, well, now we don't have to fight'? Well, of course not. That's silly. But anyway, it does contribute to the seething rage that's out there within the Arab world. And when we talk about anti-Americanism in Iraq, when we went in, it was because average Iraqis, aside from the propaganda that Saddam was disseminating, just in the normal radio and TV media of the region, are fed a daily diet of anti-American propaganda, or simply what we are doing related to Israel that pisses them off. And it has contributed massively to anti-Americanism out there.
Well, and you know, Norman Podhoretz recently said in an interview with Israeli television that he hopes and prays that Bush will bomb Iran, but that he recognizes fully that if Bush does follow through on his promise, that it will unleash a wave of anti-Americanism around the world that will make our current situation look like a walk in the park.
Absolutely. I think that's true.
Giuliani's senior foreign policy advisor there.
Yeah.
All right. We're already way over time. Thank you so much for yours today. Wayne White, everybody. He's the former deputy director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia. Really appreciate it.
Take care.
Speak the truth. This is.